welcome to the second episode of Jerry Talks. I'm really honored to have today with me the two Freds, Fred Moremi, managing partner of Centum Capital, and Fred Cambo, principal at Zoskales. Do you say Zoskales?
Zoskales.
Zoskales,
yeah.
Partners. It's a real honor for me. Both of you I know very well. Fred from, you know, working together on transactions, and Fred number two from London when we were together at university, maybe 5 years ago.
Yes, if you insist.
We're so young.
We're young.
So I'm really happy that you guys have chosen to come on the podcast, and I'm really glad that you're here, and I hope that we have a really good session. So today we're going to be talking about private equity. It's a specialization of mine, and you guys are the experts, you guys are the clients, you guys are the ones who know exactly what's going on, and we can only service and give you what you want in that space. So if we can learn anything from this, it will be how private equity works and what we should really, as lawyers, be focusing on to deliver to our clients. So we want to get to know you as well. There is no information on either of the two Freds online, aside from very minimal information. So I'm going to do three quick fire questions each.
Okay.
And then you guys can answer them. So let's start. I mean, two Freds is confusing. So we'll stick with Moremi.
That works for me.
And we'll stick with Fred. So you're the managing partner. Describe your job. What do you do every day? What's a managing partner's job?
Okay. Thanks, Jerry. It's a pleasure to be on the show and with Fred Cambo, who we're just recollecting that we were workmates about 10 years back,
yeah,
perhaps.
Yeah, something like 10 years.
But only for a few weeks. I think he came in, found me and left.
Okay.
I think I was too much for him.
I promise it was legal. We were not doing anything illegal.
Okay.
Sounds a bit dodgy.
Yeah, great. So, yeah, so my job, typical day is full of meetings. So we are invested in several companies.
Mm-hmm.
And each of them, between formal board meetings, informal meetings with management, meetings with my team, because we are always looking at opportunities, mm-hmm. to invest in.
Mm-hmm.
So there are lots of analysis. The whole business of investing is about trying to predict the future.
Yes.
And no one is right about what the future is.
Yeah.
I could have my thoughts about my teammates and what I think they are definitely missing, but no one is right.
Okay.
about the future.
Mm-hmm.
So it's always lots of discussions, lots of meetings, planning, re-strategizing.
Checking the portfolio.
Companies. 2020 has been particularly interesting, mm-hmm. because everything we had planned for did not happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How are you managing that?
Yeah, so it's interesting. So for quite a number of portfolio companies, the first thing that we thought about is how much cash do we have to run through
for the rest of the year?
For the pandemic.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. For the pandemic. First, it was just the pandemic.
How are you estimating that?
In March, of course, the thought was we've been locked down by the government for 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Many thought after 3 weeks, then Corona will be done and we'll be back.
Naively.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So I decided to spend a little time just doing a bit of research on viral pandemics.
Okay.
And in the history of viral pandemics, at least the last 100 years from the Spanish flu,
There
have been 7 viral pandemics.
Okay, wow, okay.
Okay. Of the 7, 4 have been in the last 20 years.
Wow, okay. These are things I don't even know.
Meaning that it's not new to, mm-hmm. get a viral pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
What's definitely happening is that they are coming with increasing regularity.
Okay.
Between there's the first SARS, bad flu, Asian flu, and the like.
Yeah.
So now we should be budgeting that once every 5 years.
Wow, okay.
We'll go through some viral pandemic.
I mean, this is the reason why we're doing this podcast. This is something that no one has
to avoid
anyone...
pandemic?
No, to planning. That's an excellent observation.
Yes,
okay.
Yes. Yeah. They say, unfortunately, mm-hmm. one of the things we learn from history is that we never learn from history.
And it repeats itself and we never learn.
Yes, so mm-hmm. I decided to take a lesson from history. So viral pandemics have been there.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, 7 in the last 100 years, of which 4 have been the last 20.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that was one. So after we get through COVID,
mm-hmm.
there'll be another one. Maybe 2023, 2024,
manage.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing was, of those 7 viral pandemics, the one that was with us for the shortest was 14 months.
Okay.
Okay. So I looked like a madman saying the soonest we'll be out of COVID was April 2021.
Okay.
This
was in
March.
That's reasonable.
Yes. But in March, it sounded like...
Too long.
Mm-hmm. At most, it was a 3 weeks lockdown.
Yes. Yeah.
Maybe it's extended by another few weeks. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So then now the question came up. So do our businesses have the cash to survive through... Mm-hmm. At least 12 months.
Okay.
Yeah. And so you can imagine all the calculations. People are trying to project revenue. This is the revenue. These are the profits you're going to make. So we'll be left with so much cash. You question, will we actually have the revenue?
Yeah.
The expenses are there.
Yeah.
In some cases, painful decisions had to be made about reducing costs.
So you made those decisions very early on?
We had to make those decisions very early. Okay. Because every day that we continued carrying unnecessary costs was a day that... threatened the viability of the business.
Yeah.
And so thankfully across the different portfolio companies we've managed and so far none has run out of cash.
I mean that's really good. Yeah. I mean Remy, that's why you're in your job, I guess. Tell us more. Okay, so in fact going on to the next quick fire question, and this wasn't a quick fire question, but thank you for that answer. I looked at your qualifications and you have everything on the book except for a PhD. So anything else that you're planning?
So for now, I think I've got sufficient enough qualifications to do my job.
Yeah.
If I need any more qualifications, if there's anything I'm not able to do at the current job, it's not because of lack of qualifications.
No,
I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so maybe something more internal.
So I guess, I mean, you have a wealth of experience. And I think what we need to know is it the learning or is it the experience that counts? Is it something that you would have known, you know, like how to manage the pandemic or even doing that kind of research?
Yeah.
Is it strictly, you know, innate in you?
Okay.
Or is it something that, you know, the learning has taught you?
Yeah. Okay. So for me, I've always liked to read for a long time. In fact, maybe because growing up, my dad had a bookshop. He ran a bookshop.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I'd spend my weekends, holidays in the bookshop.
Amazing.
Which gave me two things. One, it gave me the desire to make money.
Yeah. Okay.
But two, because there are lots of periods of lull, then I just picked up reading.
Yeah.
So I like to read a lot. So even when this pandemic struck, the first thing was, okay, well, I need to read.
That's
about
such a
pandemics.
I mean, you've given us gems already, which we can take away.
Yeah.
So thank you for that. I know that you're also a runner. I don't know how quick you are, but you're definitely quicker than me. Because when I saw you the last time we were I was entering the stadium you were coming out at the Beyond Zero Marathon. Uh-huh. So I know that you do that as a hobby. Why running and what other hobbies do you have?
Okay. So, so running is one of my hobbies. I picked it up about 5 years ago. Then when I started, I could barely run 2 kilometers nonstop.
Yeah.
And when I first did, I told my friend, I've run 2.5 kilometers
Amazing.
Nonstop. And he told me, and he laughed long and told me, please, in the world of running, don't even mention
2 kilometers.
Yeah. So that irritated me a bit. Mm-hmm. So I just began increasing.
And when you start running, it's an achievement for you to run without having to stop, for even for 2K.
Yes.
That's a lot.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So part of it was health reasons. Health reasons was one, but also just I do most of my running in forests. I like Karura Forest, so just that free air.
Yeah,
it helps with the distressing a lot.
And a lot of thinking that you can do as well.
A lot of processing.
Yeah,
goes on those runs, and I quickly picked up, did my first 2.5 kilometers, did 5, then did 10 kilometers, then did 15.
Yeah. So you're doing 21 now. Wow. Okay.
Then I moved to 30.
Okay. Wow.
Then now I'm doing 42. So I've done 42 kilometers thrice this year.
Wow.
Yeah.
What's the timing on that?
Can we skip that?
No. For me, doing a 5K in half, because you know I did there's a step plan you can do for 5K.
Yeah.
And I can do that in half an hour.
Yes.
I cannot imagine running for longer than 2 hours.
Yeah.
That's way.
Yeah. So it's just something I just kept pushing myself. The first 42K I ran was last year, November.
Yeah.
So I ran that. It took me 5 hours 36 minutes.
Wow. I mean, that's amazing.
That was a pace of 7 minutes 56 seconds per kilometer.
That is amazing.
So this last one, a year later, I managed to cut a minute of my pace.
And are you still going?
So
you'll do ultra marathons. Are you going to do that?
I don't know yet.
7 marathons in 7 continents.
Are you going to like Berlin, London, New York, all of that?
I don't know yet. For now, it was just let's see how far I can go.
So, do you have time to do anything else aside from the running and the obvious reading and the work?
My other hobby that I'd picked up a while back was golf.
Okay.
But because of just the amount of time it takes, I could hardly do it. So I was a public holiday golfer. Thanks to Corona, it's helped me manage my time a bit. So now I can at least do it once a week.
That's nice.
But any golfer will tell you that is just not enough.
Not enough. I think golfers are very passionate about the sport.
Yes.
Constantly looking to hit the green.
Exactly.
Let's go.
Do you play golf?
No, I don't play golf. I stick to the running and the tennis. But Fred, I know that you play polo. When we say polo, does anyone actually
that's
know?
So exotic.
I know. First of all, it's a very rich man sport. Yeah. Prince Harry and Prince William are known to play that kind of. So can you tell us how you got into it?
So I'm obsessed about competitive sport. So for a long time I played basketball to a high level for, I want to say, 20 years or so.
Wow.
But there's in a sport like basketball, a time comes when you just can't compete. Knees gone, ankles gone.
Younger, stronger.
Exactly. And so I was just getting really frustrated that I really couldn't compete the way I wanted to. And I was complaining to a friend of mine who I used to play basketball with, who now plays polo.
Okay.
And he said, you know, you should really consider polo because it's really competitive. It's a team sport, which I would like. And you can compete to really mature, let's call it a mature age, competitively.
Yeah.
So for example, at the Kenya Polo Association, you have people who are still playing in their 80s, people playing in their 70s and competing properly.
Okay.
So for me, you know, something clicked and I said, okay, this is something I can do. And yeah, so that's how I started. So I took a year to learn how to ride because that's the most important thing. Then once I learned how to ride, I went all in.
It's just occurred to me that none of my hobbies are team sports.
That's true.
I wonder what it says about you.
I think it's a self-competition because even I don't like running necessarily in, you know, these marathons and etc. because I feel like I'm being left behind. Whereas when you're doing it yourself, you're competing against yourself and, you know, training yourself. But maybe that's a lawyer thing as well. So Fred, I know that you also went to Nottingham Law School. You went to law school, so all of us are lawyers, I guess. But you decided not to go into, you know, the formal practicing route. Why?
At the risk of offending the lawyers in the room,
and there's many of us,
and there are many. Yeah. What do you call a collection of lawyers? Is it a
school?
A shark-infested pool of lawyers?
An education
of lawyers? A congress? I don't know. Anyway, you know, like Maremi, I always was reading when I was growing up. I was also very lucky in the sense that my parents were big readers, so the house was always full of books. So I was always reading, and it became one of those things where if you're always reading, people then tell you you should be a lawyer. It's one of those things. So that's part of it. The other side to this is very young, and I don't know how this ended up happening, but very young, I found this book, Barbarians at the Gate, about KKR.
I read it when I was much older.
You'd have to.
So I read it when I was something like 12 years old. It's about KKR taking over Nabisco, a big biscuit manufacturer in the States.
Okay.
I have no idea why it was in the house, but it was there. It was my mom's, and my mom has very little interest in corporate business or anything like that. And I loved it. I said, wow. This is what I want to do. I want to be in M&A and blah, blah, blah. So even when I went to law school, it was with the idea of becoming an M&A
lawyer. So you knew already?
I knew. Well, I had an idea. That's what I wanted to do.
I went to law school thinking it was all going to be a humanitarian, human rights law.
Look at you now.
Look at me now.
Wow, capitalist. So that's why I went to law school. It was to learn how to be an M&A lawyer. Then during law school, I took a year and did an internship. And this is where I'm going to offend everyone. I quickly realized that when you start, you do very little of that deal making.
Of course.
Very.
You do photocopy.
You do a lot of photocopying and that kind of stuff. And I thought, you know what, this is not for me. So I looked around. I still wanted to be in the deal world. And I thought, perhaps investment banking is the way.
Yeah.
So as soon as I finished my law degree, I went to business school, still at Nottingham.
Yeah.
And now the idea was, once I finish business school, I'm going to go into this banking story. So that's how that happened.
And I think, I mean, knowing you from London, you were always one of the most sharply dressed students that were around. So you were already in the city.
Really, he did.
I was
sharply dressed today for not listening to us.
I mean, I was hoping you'd say I was one of the sharpest people, but let's talk about dressing.
We were meeting in informal places.
This is true, not
in the business setting. Speaking of books, I know that you're a board member of BookBank. So actually I was going to ask you about books. It's good that you brought it up yourself. So
yeah.
You're on a desert island. What book would you take with you?
Oof.
Not Barbarians at the Gate.
No, that's a good question. It would be something from Stephen Fry.
Okay.
He's like such an amazing
dry
writer.
Wit.
Yeah, dry wit, but also very, very intelligent, very erudite, knows a lot about a lot of things. So right now I'm reading a book of his based on Greek mythology.
Wow,
so he's retold the Greek mythological stories.
But
in a contemporary,
and I think that's cool.
Funny way. So yeah, it would
actually
be something
when
like
I was drafting
Stephen
the
Fry.
Questions, I'd asked that question to Maremi, and then now it seems very apt. I didn't even know that your parents owned a bookshop. So what book would you take?
One book, Stranger on an Island.
Yeah.
The Bible.
To pray for you to get out.
Yeah, you know. Yeah. The only hope,
Thank you for that, because that's quite informal. And I also wanted to, you know, people need to know and see a side of, you know, there's a professional side and obviously there's an informal side all of us have. But tell us about your experiences at work. What is the highest high and the lowest low that you've experienced? Because I think people need to see that we're also human. We're not just successful transactional lawyers. Yeah. So Fred, why don't you start?
That's a good question. The highest high at work.
Mm-hmm.
The highest high at work, it's a strange one. So I want to say 4 or 3 years ago, we had an intern visiting from Pakistan. This is at a firm I was with before I went to Zoskales.
Mm-hmm.
And she spent a year with us. Really, really smart girl, lady. Really hardworking, really good with people. But anyway, when she left, she wrote me this 4-page letter, just saying how much she enjoyed spending with us, and how much she enjoyed working with me, and that she really enjoyed that I mentored her and took time with her. At no point did I ever think I was mentoring. I just thought we were doing our job. So for me, that was a big deal.
That's really nice.
Yeah, it was very, very nice.
I think people, you don't realize the impact that you have on people.
You don't.
Until after.
Yeah,
and so it's always important to bear that in mind, whoever you meet.
Mm.
Marami?
Wow. Fred sounds so...
Human.
It sounds nice.
Unlike this marathon robot. Psycho.
Sorry, I will not sound human, but it's really, I think the world of private equity is about supporting businesses, and I think one of the highest highs is when we got in one of the businesses we're invested in, and we were on this consolidation, merger, rationalizing investments, etc.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they had a very successful year. And that year, there was a bonus issued to the staff then of 200 million shillings.
Wow. Okay.
These guys would not seen bonuses of
that kind.
Of that kind.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But just seeing the appreciation in their faces of your plan worked.
It was successful.
And it's been successful, and it's touching us, fine materially.
Yeah.
But I think that's also important.
I think the thing about M&A and transactions is that really the aim is to improve whatever business you're entering into.
Correct.
And if you can do that, and if the merger is successful, it's always a reward.
I
appreciate that, because you're actually improving not only people's lives, but the economy in general.
Correct.
So there isn't just the shock invested water that people think about. But thank you for that. And what's the low, Fred?
It'll come as no surprise the low is this explosion of a barrage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's no secret. That's where I was. So yeah, I mean, it hit me particularly hard.
Yeah.
Because
was it a surprise?
It was a complete surprise.
Okay.
For me, it was a complete surprise. So there are a number of things that aligned at the same time that made it hard. So
okay.
I had just done a series of transactions. So we'd just done 4 hospitals.
Yes.
And we had just put them together.
Yeah.
So it was really high. I was at a really high point. And after I'd done that, I then went to blow some steam off. So mm-hmm. I went to the bush. Mm-hmm. I like spending a lot of time in the bush. And I was somewhere in Samburu. I think I left on Friday. And then on a Saturday, we got an email from the head of the fund saying, whatever you do, don't panic.
Okay.
Let's have a call at 5.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as someone says that, of course
you're panicking. Yeah.
What do you mean, don't panic?
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing else said.
Yeah.
So then I Google frantically and I see the story on the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah.
And then
just out of interest, what are you Googling at this point?
Abraj news, yeah. You know, that kind of thing. Yeah. Because I'm thinking, what's going on? Because he didn't explain.
Yeah.
And then obviously, because I was so remote, I hadn't been seeing the text and things that had been flying. It turned out that there'd been a lot flying. So that then I just knew, oh my, this is bad. Mm-hmm. This is really bad. And so for me, the low was that exploding, because I really thought we had something special. I thought we were doing something important, especially from my fund, which was the Global Health Fund.
Yeah.
It was the first time anyone had put $1 billion together to improve healthcare and to provide high quality care at affordable price.
Yeah.
So it was very important, this mission.
Yeah.
And that it went away, yeah, that devastated me.
Yeah, I think these things can be surprising. I mean, I remember even when we were in London and the recession hit.
Yes.
And we had, I mean, we had major plans. I was about to start being a lawyer in the city. And then.
Oh, so you went in university 5 years ago.
I mean, did you really have to go there? Did you have to?
Thanks, Fred. Okay.
Wow. There's always that guy.
Fred is that guy. That's very funny. And I just thought I was going to start working in the city, and then, you know, we were taken back a year. So that kind of
was nuts. I mean, I was at JP when the thing hit.
Yes.
And again, you're not really seeing the news. And then I see a headline, JP Morgan about to take over Bear Stearns.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, what are you people talking about?
Yeah.
And then we were called back to the office to now start doing work, modeling, blah, blah, blah. So yeah, again,
It
just comes out of nowhere.
It comes out of
kicks
nowhere.
You in the teeth.
Okay, so we've learned so much already, but I want to know something that no one would know about you. Maremi, keep it clean.
He hasn't told us about his lows, though.
Oh, sorry, let's go back to the lows.
I was hoping to skip that.
No!
What a criminal.
Thank you, Fred, for reminding me.
So I think my lows, again, around people.
Mm-hmm.
Many times we go into businesses, or we're in businesses, and we're hoping it's going to work out.
Mm-hmm.
And it does not sometimes. And in some cases, just you got to rationalize costs.
Yeah.
And then it involves laying off people.
Yeah.
Those are the toughest decisions.
When it doesn't work out.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's go to what is the one thing that someone would be surprised to know about you?
Okay. I'm a Sunday school teacher.
Seriously?
Oh, wow. That's seriously cool.
Yeah.
As in for kids or for adults or for...
Yeah, not good kids. Like human being children.
Yeah.
And I actually teach 5 to 6 year olds.
Wow, I love
that's
that.
That's super cool.
Yeah.
You would be the coolest Sunday school teacher. You know how it can be dry material, but you need to like make it like interesting. That's so cool.
It's one way to blow off the madness of the entire week.
Yeah.
With the 5 to 6 year olds.
And they must ask you like really intense questions.
Profound. That's profound. The
very,
profound
very profound
things.
Questions. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they're just so open and they share.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And their thoughts on what you've just told them.
Exactly.
And etc.
Yes. Oh, and they're also very happy to contradict the
yeah.
teacher. Yeah.
Fred, please keep yours in the same humble, biblical, and clean
tone. I mean, I could. And I wouldn't be lying, but not a Sunday school teacher. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting. So mine is completely opposite.
Mm-hmm.
But although maybe people, depends on who would be surprised or not surprised. But one of my other hobbies, apart from sport, is music. And I DJ. Okay, let me put it like this. So our speciality, I'm part of a DJ crew.
Oh, you're it's part called of a Boom crew Back as Click. Well. Okay, uh-huh.
And our speciality is hip hop.
Oh, Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay.
So that's what we do.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool. That's very cool.
Are we allowed to ask what his rates are?
Can you tell us?
Our party on Friday.
I mean, we're expensive, especially for managing partners at Centum.
Yeah, exactly.
But we can arrange a rate for for those who share names.
So
I'm happy to. Boom bap click.
Boom bap click.
Yeah.
Very boom, cool. Bap, click. Okay, yeah. So anyone can Google that.
We're on Instagram, all that stuff.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Oh, very cool. This is nice. Nice to know that we all have something else that we do apart from the work.
Mm.
But let's turn to the work now. And I think people have different perceptions of what private equity is and what it means. So what is that private equity?
Okay. So for me, my view of private equity,
mm-hmm.
it's really about supporting entrepreneurs
mm-hmm.
In two ways. One is many people will start up businesses. They'll be very successful in those businesses. And I think the continuity of those businesses is dependent on other investors coming in at some
mm-hmm.
point.
Mm-hmm.
And if you started up a business, and I think if people knew if I start up a business is going to die with me, there'd be fewer and fewer people starting businesses.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But if they know there is continuity
mm-hmm.
coming, I think then people are willing to take the plunge.
Yeah.
And
I agree with that view.
Yeah.
Fred, what do you think?
No, I think that captures it. You know, often when people hear private equity and we're talking about private equity, people think it's about, you know, the doing deals mm-hmm. and all this kind of stuff. But it's really not. It's a craft. For me, I think of it as a craft. So it's an apprenticeship business. You can't go to university to learn this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And a big part of it is exactly what Maremi said. It's about helping entrepreneurs, business people scale, helping them be successful. And there are a number of things. So there's capital, of course, but then there's also experience, value creation, access to networks, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Okay, so I think one of the things that you said, Fred, that was very interesting is about the portfolio companies themselves.
Yeah.
And if a lot of people know that there's continuity or anticipate continuity, they need to know how to manage the portfolio company to make it interesting for someone to come in, an investor to come in.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the things that we always struggle with, because when we look at the companies, the books and everything else may not be in the pristine way that an investor may want to look at. So when you're looking at a portfolio company, or potential, what do you look for exactly?
Yeah, so I think for us, the at the basic of it is this company able to generate cash?
Yeah,
because many companies that we look at, they have products, they're in the market, they're selling, but they're not getting paid.
Yeah,
so effectively, they are funding their customers.
Yeah,
so any business which is not able to generate cash and have cash in the
and
bank
extract that cash
at the end of the day,
mm-hmm.
It sounds very simple, but surprisingly, very many companies are in the business of funding their customers
mm-hmm.
rather than in the business of making money.
Mm-hmm.
So for us, it's the first question is this business actually generating cash?
Yeah. Fred, for you?
Yeah, it's the same. So the cash question is a big deal for us. It's something we really take seriously. And like Maremi says, it's simple, but often the simple things are not easy. That's a big one. And then the others are on management.
Yeah.
We really care deeply about management. We don't necessarily expect them to be perfect. But, it's things like integrity that for us is non-negotiable. Then an openness to learning, an openness to sharing ambition. And guys who work hard and who really
I've also seen that you call it the ZP way.
Yeah.
That's a social impact aspect of all your investments. So what are you looking for when you're looking for a portfolio?
So it's companies that are really doing well commercially. That's obviously really important because we are looking for a return.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, what really excites us is that aspect is married to what people these days call impact.
Mm-hmm.
I hesitate to say that here because it means so many different things to so many different people.
Yeah.
And it's become a bit of a buzzword.
Yes.
So,
agreed.
I try to play it down. But I do feel, and my partners as well, we do feel a responsibility for where we operate. just because we're from here. It's not even that deep.
So in the East African region?
Yeah. So we want to see this region do well. We want to invest in businesses that help us in that mission. Mm-hmm. And so that's a big part of the ZP way.
Yeah, that's great. Let's go. You've now identified the portfolio company and you're now getting to the actual deal itself. Mm-hmm. I'm going to talk about the Genesis transaction because we worked on it together, Miami. Yeah. We didn't sleep. We did a 3-day, exercise of trying to get the SPA signed.
Yeah.
And for me, the most interesting thing was, first of all, your determination to get it signed at any cost. You know, I don't care who leaves the room, who doesn't leave the room. And also the commercial considerations, which were a big factor.
Yeah.
And in fact, I remember you telling me, you know, you need to go back to your client, Jerry. Ask the client what they want. Yeah. Because sometimes legal reasoning gets in the way of actual what the commercials are. So it may not be important to the client,
sure.
But it may be a legal point.
Mm.
Yeah. So tell us about that process and how you see that process. What is the best kind of process for you?
Okay, super. So to the two questions you raised. So the first one, as far as closing deals, I believe in striking it while it's hot.
Yeah.
Because sometimes if you drag it out, there's too many lawyers in the room, each of them wanting to show how clever they are.
that was not me.
No, of course not. So once you've sort of... the parties are sure that we are doing this deal.
Yeah.
It's better to close it as quickly as possible because stuff happens.
Yeah.
Things change. We closed a deal. There's a deal we closed November 2019. If we had waited another 2-3 months with COVID.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Nothing would have happened.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So sometimes you got to accept what seems to be a non-ideal transaction in terms of transaction terms, but I'm a firm believer in the 80-20 principle. Once you've got 80% agreed, just close.
Just close.
The other 20%, it's neither. We can debate it academically.
But let's just do it.
But let's just close. Strike it while it's
lawyers. I will say for myself, we want to perfect the document, get everything pristine and nice and neat.
Yes.
And that's not always possible. But I like
that's
that.
True.
It's a very commercial approach.
Exactly.
Fred.
From our point of view and from my experience, it's at the risk of being really boring, it's the same thing. You don't have to get every single detail right.
Mm-hmm.
I like what Moremi said, you know, strike while the iron is hot or when the deal is still, when it can still be done.
Mm-hmm.
And it's true, things change. And it can be as simple as moods changing, priorities changing, because this is not the most important thing in the world that's happening for anyone, right? Mm-hmm. So things can change. And as soon as you have parties that are willing to do it, be practical, be commercial, find a way to get it done. But I think the other thing I would add is, even when things get heated, just keeping a cool head.
Very cool.
And realizing, look, this is not the most important thing. We're not saving the world. We're not doing brain surgery.
Yeah.
Everyone calm down. It's not about I need to show that I'm the cleverest guy in the universe.
Yeah.
Just everyone calm down and remember that if this deal happens, we're going to have a relationship
post
all this.
So if you find a portfolio company and you don't gel with the founders or the people who will remain, because at the end of the day you're not buying 100%.
Yeah.
What is your approach to that? Is it more important for the personalities to work than the actual deal itself?
I'm not sure you can divorce the two. I'm not sure it's either or it's binary. For me, I think it's important for the personalities to gel, especially between the principals on the PE side and the principals on the company side. I think it's super important. So I think, at least for me in my deal making, a lot of time is just spent getting to know people.
Getting to know people. Yeah.
To understand, is this someone that I can live with? It is a marriage, really.
It is.
I've actually thought, many times, many employers will do psychometric testing on their employees coming in.
Yeah.
And it's employer-employee relationship.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think for in the PE space, I hope we can one day normalize.
Psychometric.
Completely agree. Yeah.
Yeah.
Completely.
Plus maybe marriages as well.
Especially marriages. What? Who said that?
For friend, I think it's a very Mermi, you have a happy marriage.
Very happy.
Fred is the most good save. Bachelor in Nairobi.
Good save.
So Mermi, what do you think? And I also want to understand from you, when you're looking at a transaction, what are the non-negotiables? Like, for example, is it a board seat minimum that you must ask for? What do you want to see for yourself on the deal?
Okay. So for me, it's it's mainly around, because for us, what we're chasing is return.
Yeah.
So it's really a question of what sense do I have, mm-hmm. that the cash flows I'm expecting, mm-hmm. will actually be generated and delivered.
Yeah.
So it's really around the control of cash flows is a key. Now, how it will vary from deal to deal.
Okay.
In some cases, maybe we do need control of the board, for instance. Mm-hmm. In some other cases, maybe I shouldn't even be on the board.
Okay.
I might be destroying value if I go onto the board.
Yeah.
So it's really around, particularly if you have a good management team. Board meetings can be pretty much formal affairs.
How do you make that assessment, though? Because, you know, it's always very time restrained.
Yeah. Yes.
The transaction has happened. The due diligence is just telling you very concrete information about the business itself, but not about how it's run.
Correct.
How do you make that assessment?
Yeah. So I think part of the due diligence really has got to be around assessing the people you're going to be entering into partnership with. Mm-hmm. And so if you're not getting a good sense of that you can trust the management, then you've got to now build very many controls around that.
Yeah, okay.
That's when you look for board seats, you even want to approve budgets, you want to even be signatories to the bank accounts.
Yeah.
In some other cases, it's a credible management team. And you just wait for your dividend check.
Let me ask for lawyers, because when we do a due diligence for you, and Fred, you can also answer this, we don't get into that kind of detail.
Yeah.
How can we help you as a PE, you know, the manager, to get that understanding?
Yeah.
What can we do to improve our own delivery?
Okay. So I think what lawyers could do in this whole process is there's always a... I think once lawyers understand that we are in for return, mm-hmm. looking at the future, mm-hmm. where is the cash going to come from, mm-hmm. Then looking back and saying, okay, if we expect this company to be able to pay out $1 million every year because they are going to be generating turnover of 10 million, and these are the expenses, etc. As you're going through the due diligence, it's then testing those assumptions. In the past, have they done this?
Okay.
So continuously testing the assumptions that the incoming investor is making.
Okay, fine. So I think that's a very good question to ask at the beginning. What is your assumption on the business?
Yes.
I mean, for me, where I see lawyers really, really shining is when they themselves see themselves as beyond mere technicians.
Yeah.
So it's not about contracts. It's not about due diligence checklists and that kind of thing. What I find very valuable is a lawyer who's self-confident enough to think of themselves as a counselor to a client or an advisor.
Yeah.
So they take a wide view. Yes, we're going to do this documents. Yes, we're going to do this due diligence. But do you mind if I spend some time with this management team?
Yeah.
And then I can come and give you a sense
of what they're all about.
Because you, as lawyers, you've seen so many businesses, you've seen so many transactions. And so if you're able to come and tell me, you know, something smells fishy about this guy, it's not going to show up in any documents, mm-hmm. But just the way they comport themselves makes me feel nervous.
Okay.
Or the way they're responding to questions we're asking makes me feel like you'll have a problem with them once you're in. So,
and I think that's very important.
For me, look, and that's where this thing is going, right? With automation, AI, more and more the technical aspects are going to become less and less valuable.
Yeah.
It's
and
less
actually
about
the due diligence, we can reduce it to one page.
Yeah.
We can tell you know, these contracts need a change of control, so you will have to do this.
Yeah.
These are the number of employees. This, you know, we can tell you the rudimentary, but we can't get into the nitty-gritty without actually having that interaction.
Yeah.
And getting to know, giving you more than just the technicals. Yeah. So that's very helpful, I think. So let's go into 2021. Mm-hmm. You've predicted April 2021, Mermi, for the start of basically the year, or financial year, as it were.
Yes. Yeah.
What are your predictions for what it will look like after April?
Yeah. Of course, now we are just getting the news of a new variant. Yeah. So I don't know whether that extends this pandemic runway even further out.
We also have news that the variant is going to work for the vaccine.
Yes.
Or at least, you know, they're saying that it will work.
Or rather, the vaccine will work for the
exactly.
Yes, okay.
So it may not be as bad.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So assuming the vaccine works and is widely distributed as we anticipate, then we should begin seeing recovery of economic activity.
Do you think quick recovery or a slow burn?
So it's likely for my view is particularly in developing economies, and again just going back to history, mm-hmm. whenever we've had a crisis, viral pandemic or economic crisis or the like, developing economies take a while longer than the developed.
Yeah.
And typically it's been, developed economies would be typically a year later. Mm-hmm. Developing economies is another year after the developed economies.
Okay.
So we may continue to see subdued economic activity probably until 2022.
Okay.
Perhaps.
Fred?
That's my working assumption.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. Right. I mean, so for me, the things I've been reading suggest, at least for East Africa, which is for us, that's really where we operate, the consensus forecast seems to be that growth will really rebound quickly.
Quickly.
Yeah. That. But like Fred, I'm quite skeptical. And even if it does, and when they talk about growth, they're really talking about things like GDP. Mm. But how does GDP translate to cash from a portfolio company point of view, or indeed food on people's plates?
Yeah.
So, I mean, yay for GDP growth. It helps us with our documents when we're going fundraising. It's wonderful. But I think from a portfolio company point of view, it's probably going to be a slow burn. We were fortunate in our situation from the point of view where all our portfolio companies so far this year performed better than they did last year.
That's amazing.
Well done. But they didn't perform as well as the budgets that we had set, had anticipated. So there's still some underperformance from that point of view. And I think we're going to be here for a while. I think it's 2022.
But Murami, after all of that research, isn't the lesson for us to be self-reliant and not reliant on developed nations so that we can then be prepared for the next pandemic?
Yeah.
We need to be building our own infrastructures.
Yeah, that's true. If I took a very, maybe not pessimistic view, if I took a view that there's of course a lot of interest in Africa, there's a lot of interest in developing economies.
Yeah.
The question is, will the developed or other countries allow us to flourish as we should?
Okay, that's a very interesting.
Yeah.
So you think that they're holding us back?
I think, speaking purely economically,
that's fine.
There is good reason
for them to
want to hold us back.
That's a very interesting point.
Yeah.
And I think we're not helping ourselves really in like governmental governance structures in order for us to propel ourselves further.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the private sector can do a lot about that, can't it?
I think the private
Centum
sector
specifically can do.
Yes, Centum.
I can assure you, us and many of us are doing everything possible.
Yeah.
Of course, because we're here, we're invested in the economy, and we all want to see the economy growing and booming. So I think we are pretty much doing as much as we can. And of course, there's always room for improvement.
Yeah.
But we do need to have conversations, private sector, government, our political leaders, people of goodwill, because there's many international, even in the developed countries,
True.
Who are people of goodwill and want
and
to
want
see
to
us flourish, without a doubt.
Yeah.
We all need to work together at this.
Well, let's hope for the best. I mean, definitely what Fred is on the opposite side of you, so one of you will be right and we will see. Obviously, we all hope, you know, for lawyers particularly, for a quick recovery, which means better and bigger transactions for us. The diversification of the type of investment, so for example pipes, is that something that you guys are looking at as well?
From our point of view, it's not really in our mandate. I think they're interesting. I think there's certainly something something to pursue there. You know, we're fortunate you know, we've just been speaking about how hard it is for us, or the kinds of challenges that exist for us given where we're operating. But on the other side of the coin, it also means the opportunity is much larger.
I still
laugh about all the hoopla and euphoria around Africa Rising and what actually happened with that.
It hasn't
really lived up to all the euphoria.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean that the opportunity isn't there.
Yeah.
It just means it's more difficult.
Yeah.
So for me, from my point of view, even though our mandate specifically doesn't allow us to do things like pipes or real estate or whatever, I think systemically there's a huge opportunity. And
yeah,
the more people who come and do it, the better. I think different asset classes, different.
Yeah. What about you?
Yeah, well, so for us, thankfully, we've got a pretty wide mandate.
Yeah.
And I'd say perhaps in terms of possibly any sector that one wants to be in, you can't ignore the...
So airlines.
Yeah, let's park that for a while. You can't, as an investor, you can't ignore what's happening.
Because
in many cases, those are the largest entities in any sector.
Mm-hmm.
They are dominant, they have a strong market position.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And from a return point of view, from also just growing the economy, growing the sector, sometimes there's a case for making an investment in a public entity already. Then looking to
and
grow
raising
small,
that standard, because sometimes, you know, that public sector element means that there's a lack of the stringentness that private equity can bring to that kind of investment. So 2021, let's package it in one word. What's your word, Fred?
2021, resilience.
Mm-hmm.
I really think we still have to be resilient. Keep an eye on things. It's not on off and suddenly now we're winning again.
Yeah.
So I think we have to be resilient in mind and in spirit to be ready to fight. I think we still need to fight.
To fight.
Yeah.
2021.
Yeah. Pretty much the same for me. It's one phrase is we are not out of the woods yet.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Both from a public health point of view.
Mm.
Also economic activity.
Economic.
We are not out of the woods yet. So I think there's a good case to make that let's continue to be conservative, both in terms of how we interact with people from a public health point of view, but also for businesses that they're projecting, let's continue to be conservative, particularly around how we spend, how we invest, because we might be in this season
for a while,
a few more months.
Well, we'll see how it goes and we'll keep in touch. And thank you so much for joining me on the podcast.
It's been
so great. It's been so funny, like I expected. Thank you for bringing your best selves.
Oh, yes.
See you in court.
See you guys. Thank you so much.
Thank you.